Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And hi, I'm Will Leach, and this is the Grierson's Podcast, episode 174. Right before we started recording this podcast, Grierson, there was music going on when I connected to Grierson, who I'm talking to right now. Hi, Grierson.
Hello.
Before we just got going, Grierson had some music playing. I was like, Grierson, what's that music you got there? Because sometimes, you know, he writes about music. He's got to have music. It's part of his job. He wouldn't listen to music otherwise. It's just a job requirement.
If not for this job, it would be silence around here all the time. I had some music on. You're like, hey, I'm enjoying this delightful tune. What is it?
And you told me it was.
It's I'm So Humble, right? Isn't that's the name of the Lonely Island?
Yeah, I'm So Humble from the Lonely Island song.
Yes.
Yeah, which is a very funny song. I would argue the only good thing Adam Levine has ever... Actually, I would say the two good things that Adam Levine has ever been part of are both Lonely Island songs, actually.
And that 130 Rock episode where he goes, nice to meet.
That's right, yes. But we were discussing, I guess on a little conversation, we're going to take it briefly talk about it here before we get started with the show, about the Lonely Island. And I have to tell you, I don't love the new Lonely Island. I'm a big Lonely Island fan. I think they're really funny. I still have the idea that I still believe the Bin Laden song is the funniest thing they've ever done. Though I think YOLO is close just because it has an incredible Kendrick Lamar verse where he just starts talking about prudent financial decisions right in the middle of the song. But I actually did not think the new thing, which is baseball, which, you know, it seems up my alley. I don't actually think it's that great. Do you like it?
I mean, it's like, it's okay. It's like, I have a lot of goodwill stored up with them. And so, or do they have goodwill stored up with me? I guess that's more accurate. Right. And so, like, I enjoy seeing them. It's fun seeing Maya Rudolph. It's fun seeing Will Leach show guest, Stephanie Beatriz, on there as well. It's fun to see them together. It's fun, watching, guys who are not athletic dress up as Mark McGwire and Jose Canseco, but it's, I don't think the songs are that good. And I don't think I get the idea it's supposed to be a parody of a visual album, but even that I don't think is actually very funny. It's okay, but it's not great.
So give me, before we get going, what's your favorite Lonely Island song?
God, I knew you were going to ask me that. We debated this a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's something, I'd be tempted to say something off of Incredibad because I just love that album. It was actually in my top 10 that year. I loved it so much. It changes. I'm tempted to say Space Olympics. I might go with an oldie but goodie. I'd say maybe Lazy Sunday is still my all-time favorite.
Oh, okay. I can't go that far. But yeah, I think I'm probably a Bin Laden guy. This is also one last reminder because this is a movie podcast. Just because a Bin Laden song is great, and I'm So Humble is great, and a couple other songs are great, that does not actually make Popstar great. I think Popstar is good. Popstar. Go back and listen to our Popstar. We talked about Popstar.
Oh, one person who listens to our podcast is not going to be happy that you said that.
It's good. That movie's good.
I agree. Popstar is good. Popstar is solid.
It runs entirely out of gas.
It runs out of gas, and the songs are only half really good.
Yeah. And by the end, it's like, okay, remember when we were funny with Michael Bolton? Remember when we were funny with Justin Timberlake? And it's like, yeah. Now you This is the Grierson Leach Podcast, episode 174. Remind you, as always, to follow us on Twitter at Grierson Leach. Email us, GriersonLeach@gmail.com. Go to our website, GriersonLeach.com. Go to GriersonLeach.com/RSVP. See a list of every single movie we've talked about on there. Here, podcast. I just finished book revisions, Grierson, by the way. I just finished book revisions, which is good because I finally will have a chance to go into GriersonLeach.com/RSVP, which I've not had a chance to do, and update it. Since we switched over to our new corporate overlords, we have not, I've not had a chance to update the archive where we can get all the shows immediately. So I'm actually going to have time to do that this week. So because of that, go to GriersonLeach.com/RSVP. It'll be really fun. You'll like it. Follow us on Twitter, I said, at Grierson Leach, so on. Opening songs by Dylan Mayer, Gone Cuthbert, Avenue, find on Bandcamp, SoundCloud. Closing songs, My Friend Mary. Albums, short songs, of Melancholy Longings. Facebook page, My Friend Mary. I think you can get a t-shirt, Grierson. Where can you get the t-shirt?
That would be a website called ComBureau.com.
ComBureau.com, he says. That's where you can get the t-shirt. Get yourself porked. Hey, Grierson, people should subscribe to us. They subscribe to us on Google Play, Stitcher, Overcast, SoundCloud, Spotify, iHeartRadio. But the best way to subscribe to us is on Apple Podcasts and iTunes, which is still around. By the way, I feel obliged to point out, iTunes is still hanging around. So, hey, it's got that going for it.
We should just adopt the philosophy that iTunes actually is completely going away and everyone's music collection is disappearing and just hold to that belief, even though it's not, in fact, true.
Yeah. Did you read Stephen Hyden's piece about iTunes, by the way? I thought that was really good.
Yes, I also thought it was very good.
Anyway, subscribe to us on iTunes / Apple Podcasts and give us a review. 5 stars if you could, please. When you give us a review, give us the name of a movie you would like to discuss in our reboot discussion, and we will discuss it. This week, we do have a reboot movie, and this time, finally, me using the Canadian reboot.
If we waited long enough, it was going to pay off.
Yes, this one comes to us from OJ in Candeza from January 2nd. 2017. 5 stars go to movie podcast, says OJ. Fans since Deadspin. Normally I prefer him under a half an hour, but this was never ever too long. Good thing, because it's never going under half an hour, pal. Not sure which I was more surprised by, that they both hated Fletch so thoroughly, or that their reasons for doing so made such logical sense.
Yes. I give this review 5 stars. This is a fabulous review.
I mean, honestly, logical sense is Chevy Chase. Anyway, so his reboot request come, OJ says, reboot request Pontypool, the 2008 Canadian kinda sorta zombie film. So in our reboot, we will be discussing Pontypool. However, we have 3 new movies to discuss. I've only seen 2 of them, so Grisha's going to solo for a bit. It's everyone's favorite little moment in one of these podcasts. We are going to start this week's podcast with a review of the new movie, Dark Phoenix.
She should be dead.
Did you hear what the kids are calling you? Phoenix.
Hello, Jean. Who are you? The better question is, who are you?
Something's happening to me.
When I lose control, bad things happen.
Dark Phoenix is the 12th, and trust me, we know it's the 12th because we just ranked all X-Men movies for Vulture. The 12th of the X-Men movies is written and directed by Simon Kinberg, who wrote a lot of the previous X-Men movies. He is directing this one now because Bryan Singer is such a persona non grata that they nominated Bohemian Rhapsody for Best Picture. Want to talk about Rocketman some more, Gerson? No, you don't. I don't either. Dark Phoenix is the 12th movie, and I think it's the 4th or 5th movie with the cast with James McAvoy as Professor Xavier and Michael Fassbender as Magneto, Jennifer Lawrence still hanging around. Basically, the whole old X-Men crew kind of together for one last run before Fox is bought by Disney or is officially absorbed into Disney, and the X-Men become part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and there's all a new cast. They figure out what they're going to do with it, so on. Corporate crap. This is the last one of those X-Men movies. This one basically features, the main part of this one is Sophie Turner, who plays Jean Grey. This is apparently an adaptation of the Dark Phoenix comic book series in the X-Men, which was funny because I think they've already done this, right?
The Brett Ratner
X-Men tried this story. They're basically doing this one again, but what happens is at the beginning of the movie, the X-Men, who at this point are very popular, like there have been most of the X-Men movies, the X-Men have been kind of outcasts or kind of people have been out them or try to test them out or put them in jail or kill them or whatever they're going to do. Here they're very beloved. And so they go out into space. They go out into space to try to figure out to save a space shuttle, which is stranded and the crew is stranded. There's some sort of energy surge that happens that goes directly into poor Jean Grey, and therefore she has all these incredible powers that she does not understand, and it turns her into kind of a bad guy there for a while. So the rest of the X-Men all have to get together, including the good guys and the bad guys. There's actually kind of a funny, if unintentionally funny moment where Charles Xavier and Magneto, Fassbender and McAvoy are like, about to, they basically acknowledge that this is like the 3rd time that they've been on opposite sides and have to come back together to fight something and unite. They're kind of like, yeah, here we go again with this speech again. So, and that's generally kind of the problem with this movie. It's the last one in the franchise. And I think it's telling, it's not really Dark Phoenix's fault that it comes so quickly on the heels of Avengers Endgame. But of course, Avengers Endgame was meticulously plotted out, for better or worse, to all kind of end in this big moment. Whereas the X-Men movies, because of some of the corporate stuff that's going on with them and ownership and who's a part of it and how long it's been between movies and just the different timelines, everything, it has not necessarily been able as meticulously put together to where you get a big ending. This is a This basically just kind of sputters to the finish. This has had the feel, they showed it really late in screenings, and it's certainly, there's been a lot of reshoots. It has had the vibe of like a huge turkey really for a while now, particularly coming in the wake of X-Men Apocalypse, which Grierson liked, but nobody else did. And this is not worse. True, but
please continue.
Okay, anyway, this is definitely worse than Apocalypse. However, I don't think it's a massive disaster. I think it's mostly just listless and a little dull, a little bored. Most of the actors look like they are very, very ready to be done with this. Much has been made about the fact that Michael Fassbender is in like 10 years, 8 years, he turns into Ian McKellen, but does not, in the timeline of the movies, but certainly does not look like he is turning into Ian McKellen anytime soon, to say the very least. I've got to mention Jessica Chastain's the bad guy in this. It's hard to even remember these things. She's like an alien or something, who cares. And more to the point, it's clear, we joked before about how a lot of actors are just kind of stuck in the contract in this movie. This movie feels like everyone involved, actors, directors, everyone involved with it, was just kind of playing out the string. They really weren't into it very much. At one point, a major character dies, and you would think that this would be a big emotional moment, and if you really kind of feel nothing. The movie doesn't really slow down very much to kind of acknowledge it. It's not terribly put together, but it's definitely kind of all over the place. It really looks like everyone just kind of wanted to get it over with. It's a shame, as we will know, having done so many of the X-Men movies for Vulture, there's some good movies here. There's some good movies in the X-Men series. This is not one of them, and this is definitely a conclusion that will probably make people not miss them very much. This thing's pretty tired from the beginning.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way, where I don't think it's bad. It just feels, the word that I used in my review and that has been kind of used in a bunch, is just anticlimactic. It sort of feels like, oh, this is it? And that is, I think, kind of the main problem. The other main problem is that this movie is trying to be more of a sort of a feminist X-Men movie. It's more centered around the female characters in theory. And also in theory, it is supposed to be this idea that Charles Xavier, played by James McAvoy, he's supposed to understand that in some ways that while he has had the best of intentions by bringing all of these misfit mutants who were kind of unloved in the world and gave them a home, that he kind of comes to realize that he's actually kind of patronizing in the way that he kind of coddles everybody and thinks that he knows best. And that's supposed to be like his realization in the movie. The problem is it's just not really well developed. I would argue that I do think that the movie knows that the Michael Fassbender line in this movie is funny, and that they are kind of aware of the repetition of that. And also Magneto's just general like, oh God, Charles Xavier doing his like goody-goody Pollyanna thing. I think that the movie is aware of that. If nothing else, this movie reminded me that I do think Michael Fassbender is really good in these movies. It is kind of a waste of his time and talent for him to be in these movies. But I actually do think he's really good. And when he shows up, I think the movie kind of surges to life. I think it helps the film. And I actually liked Jessica Chastain. We have talked in the past on the podcast about how, in some ways, Jessica Chastain, for as talented as she is, does certain types of roles a lot. And one type of role that she does is the steely, icy, like unfeeling character. And she can do that pretty well, but she's also done a lot. I actually kind of liked her in this, sort of like walking around in high heels the entire time, very slowly as she's methodically killing people along the way as she's trying to find Jean. My favorite thing that came out this week, I don't know if you saw this, Will, was that Jessica Chastain floated the theory that the character that she is playing in the movie is actually herself. Have you seen this?
No.
Okay, so her theory is this. She is married to an Italian man. In the movie, the husband character that you never see in the movie, like you see him like once, is in fact Italian. And so she wondered, could she in fact be playing Jessica Chastain, who gets taken over by a shape-shifting alien who kills her and then assumes her body or assumes her form when she's going around killing people and searching for Jean Grey because she wants the power that Jean Grey has? what if that character is in fact Jessica Chastain? I argue that makes Dark Phoenix 20% more fun. However, it has the Ocean's 12 problem, though, which
yes,
is other
yes.
people would say, wait a second, isn't that Zero Dark 30 star Jessica Chastain fucking straight up murdering people across the planet? Nonetheless, yes. once I read that after I'd seen the movie, it did make me laugh. And I did think that'd be kind of funny if it was in fact Jessica Chastain. Spoiler alert, it's not really Jessica Chastain playing herself in the movie. But listen, you will cling to whatever straw you can. I will say that I think that some of the action sequences are not bad. There's a thing with a train near the end, which I think is actually kind of fun. I also thought Hans Zimmer's score, he does a lot of superhero movies. This is not one of his all-time best, but I actually kind of liked his score. I like that. But for me, like just watching this, it felt like, we talked about this with Endgame. The Endgame felt like the final episode of a long-running and beloved TV series. You had to kind of tie up all the loose ends. This is the type of series finale where nobody's watching the show anymore. And so it's kind of like, oh, right, that's still on the air. And because we haven't discussed where Dark Phoenix ended up in the rankings for Vulture, I'm very curious to see where it ranked. For me, it's like, I would say that first Wolverine movie is worse than this, because that's more outwardly just like outright bad. This to me just seems generally uninspired. I think its story is potentially more kind of compelling than some of the shittier X-Men movies, but when I walked out of it, I was just kind of like, it was a hard movie to write about because I just didn't feel inspired about anything I had seen.
Yeah, so let's talk about that, because there's really not much more to talk about the movie. I think everybody sort of understands. Because I will say only briefly that this is, it is amazing to me how much, I will give the X-Men franchise credit for this. It is amazing how good some of these actors are and how long they've been stuck with this movie. I mean, like, even from down the line, never minding Fassbender and Jennifer Lawrence, who are, I think, would argue, not only two of the best actors working right now, but, like, Nicholas Holt and Ty Sheridan, like, all the way down the line. McAvoy, I think, after Glass, I'm a little itchy on McAvoy right now. But otherwise, I think like Fassbender and Lawrence and Holt, like these guys are like, these are huge stars and like really great actors. It's so fun to see them just so, like Lawrence in particular feels very like, how many lines do I have? Like, how many lines do I have on this thing? I'll get through it. Which is fine because she like dragged herself across the finish line so many Hunger Games movies. Like by the end, like, you know, I felt like she never like stopped being invested in those movies, where here she clearly is. It's hard to blame her, really. But going back to those rankings, because peek behind the curtain, America. But when we do these rankings, we had kind of settled on the rankings of the 11, and then I saw Dark Phoenix, and because we didn't want to talk about until this podcast, that's how much we care about you, listener, that we didn't want to talk about the movie until we did this podcast. Grierson just kind of trusted me to put it in the right spot. I put it 10th. I put it was ahead of that Wolverine movie, and it was ahead of
Last Stand.
And 11th is Last Stand. Yes, that's great. Yes, and then this was 10th.
Yeah, I think that's about right. I mean, you could argue, but who would want to or listen to someone else argue about Last Stand versus this movie? Because I think both of these Jean Grey stories have the same problem where they can't figure out what to do with it, and you have good actors, kind of trying, but it just doesn't work. I haven't read any of the comments, which is a general rule of thumb I have, but because I had, since we were going to talk about this live as we record this, how mad are people at us about Logan? They're pretty mad, right? I'm assuming they are.
Yeah, we had Logan 6th. We are Logan skeptics. Yeah. We talked about Logan on this podcast. We are very much skeptics of Logan. It was still 6th, but behind First Class, a movie a lot of people don't like very much. So
I think that... Which is surprising, I have to say. People don't like... Because I remember when First Class came out, there was a general sense of like, oh, it's good. It's like a nice, solid, start the franchise over kind of movie. I wondered if people would be pissed at us because we have the first Deadpool higher, and people be like, how dare you? Because, you know, Logan's like serious and Deadpool's like...
Deadpool's silly. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, screw that. Anyway, first, by the way, was X-Men Days of Future Past from 2014, which is really good across the board.
Yes, and it's a sign of just the general problem that came after Days of Future Past, that one of the best things in that movie Evan Peters doing the sped up, slowed down thing, his character, they do it again in this movie. And it's like, oh, that's like the only, like, if you go to one dinner party with him, it's really fun because he does that trick. But if you go to like three or four of them, it's like, oh, Jesus, are you going to do that fucking thing again where you like, yeah. And the answer is that yes, he is going to do that.
All right. So what'd you give it?
I just gave it a C+.
Oh yeah, I was a C-. I was farther down than that. I think it kind of had to be because it's just, I get it. I understand what you're saying. I'm not as offended and think it's as horrible as I think a lot of people is, but it's definitely not good, and it definitely goes on for too long. All right, so that is Dark Phoenix, not X-Men. Dark Phoenix, by the way.
Yes, apparently the overseas it is still X-Men : Dark Phoenix.
--. We live in the age of movies with constant hyphens.
Yeah, M-Fallout.
All right, so now we go to our second new movie of the week, and that movie is Late Night.
She was the first female late night talk show host on a major network, winning 43 Emmy Awards. Ladies and gentlemen, Catherine Newbery.
Catherine, do you think women are funny?
Funny is funny.
As long as you're white, male, and from an elite college, like your writing staff.
We need to hire a woman.
Would a gay guy work?
No.
Late Night was written by and stars Mindy Kaling. Who doesn't love Mindy Kaling? Mindy Kaling plays a woman who works at it's not a factory, it's a chemical plant. Her name is Molly, and through sort of amusing set of circumstances, she ends up getting her dream job, which is to be a writer for a talk show that is run by Catherine Newbery, who's played by Emma Thompson. In the world of Late Night, the movie, Catherine Newbery is the longest running, I believe she's the longest running late night talk show host, because her show started in 1991, so Conan started in 93, so if he exists in this world, she is the longest running late night talk show host, and she's certainly the only woman in Late Night. She's been popular for a long time, but in the last 10 years or so, she's been kind of mailing it in. And the new boss of her network, played by Amy Ryan, who shows up and just gives exposition on occasion, she informs Catherine that she is canceling the show in a year. Aha! But there's a twist to this, which is that if Catherine can maybe get the ratings back up and have people kind of fall back in love with her and her show, maybe she can avoid cancellation. Now, Molly, played by Mindy Kaling, is the only woman on her all-male writing staff. They resist her and resent her at first, but the more that Molly spends time with Catherine realizes, oh, maybe Molly has some ideas that the guys I have working for me don't. Maybe I should listen to her more than the guys who work on my show. So here's my feeling about Late Night. I did not see this at Sundance, where it was kind of a big hit and got picked up by Amazon there at the festival. And I talked to people who had seen it at Sundance, and the general consensus was it's a real crowd pleaser. It may not be a great movie, but it's really fun and it's going to do really well over the summertime. And that's kind of generally how I feel. I have some reservations about this movie, though I found myself really rooting for it through my reservations. One of them is that as much as I really enjoy this cast, which includes Hugh Dancy and John Lithgow and Will Leach show guest Reed Scott, and also personal supporting actor favorite Dennis O'Hare. Anytime he's in a movie, I'm always more excited because he's awesome. And he's actually really good as the producer of Catherine's show. It's a good cast, and I like these people. I like just hanging out with them. My reservation is that I wish it was maybe, say, 5% less in a fantasy world. I get that in some ways that's kind of where Late Night operates, that it's supposed to be a movie that is about the high-stakes world of late-night talk shows, but also kind of wants to be a fanciful, wouldn't it be nice if life was more like this kind of movie? There's like a James L. Brooks quality to this film. It's directed by Nisha Ganatra, who has done a lot of television recently, though she's done films in the past. And the film, I think, in general, is maybe a little softer than I would have liked. This doesn't have to be the Larry Sanders Show, but I did find myself thinking, if everything was just 5% sharper, or things that happened were like maybe 5% tougher in terms of how characters had to deal with things, I think it would elevate everything. I think it specifically would elevate where the main themes of this movie, which is this idea of this is a very much a male-driven world, and what would happen if more women were allowed into this world. I found myself rooting for the movie and rooting for the ideas behind this movie. I think the execution is kind of hit or miss. There are things that happen because they are convenience, and I wish that that was not the case with this film. But much is saved and forgiven because I think Emma Thompson's really fun in this. I really liked her in this. And for me, it was a reminder of just how long my love affair with Emma Thompson has been going on. I feel like me and most people my age, at least in America, got to really know her from a movie like Howard's End in the early 90s, where she won Best Actress at the Oscars. And, you know, she's done great work since then, but it's been kind of harder to find kind of good roles for her in major movies. She's actually going to be in Men in Black International next week. This is the kind of platform that I really kind of enjoy her in. I also wish that her character was a little funnier and a little sharper, to be perfectly honest. And yet I was willing to forgive this movie enough, its limitations, because I think she's good. I think Mindy Kaling is fun in it. And this is a world I just like. I like late night talk shows. I'm interested in the behind the scenes stuff. This movie is not great by any stretch. It is good enough for me to recommend.
Yeah, I couldn't quite get there, Grierson, for a lot of the things that you talk about. And I think that like 5%, you talk about being 5% tougher. I think it needs to be more than 5% tougher. This feels like the outline of a movie about late night, the late night world, rather than an actual thing about the late night world. Now, you're right. It doesn't have to be Larry Sanders' show, but like even something like I know, like, boy, here's something fun that I'm going to do, Grierson. I'm going to compare this this female driven late night comedy with something that Louis C.K. did. This will make me very popular. But even when Louis C.K. did his kind of half arsed thing about Letterman on his show, it felt like it had more knowingness of what was going on in late night than this. And I feel like what this does is it touches on everything, but doesn't actually delve into everything. The world of late night, which is kind of interesting, and but really doesn't really go past. They're either really lazy or they keep all-nighter things. And that's not really, they're working really hard or they're not working at all. That, it was funny, some of the montage sequences in this of people working or not working reminded me very much of a sports movie. That when the team is winning, everything's going awesome. They get a home run every play. And then when things are going horrible, everyone is so miserable all the time. So I feel like that's kind of lax. The stuff about Emma Thompson is great in this. I don't know if her character is funny enough. And I don't mean that like she doesn't play her funny or Emma Thompson is not a funny person and doesn't play this character well. But the jokes aren't sharp. The jokes actually aren't that great. Even like the joke that like the joke that's supposed to show her personality, to show how she moves forward. It has this. It's not funny, really that funny or original or sharp. This also has a little bit of the Studio 67, Studio 63, whatever that movie, 62 and 47, whatever the Aaron Sorkin TV show was.
Studio
60. 54, Studio 60. So that's it. One of those studios. Yeah. The problem with that was that like it was a comedy show, but none of the comedy bits were funny. And I think that's a problem here. There's actually even there's an interview segment. So that's it gets that wrong. I don't think that's that funny. There's the generational aspect of the movie, which is to say that like, hey, there's this person that's been doing this for too long. Now we're getting someone young and cool and understands social media in there. And that'll kind of jazz her up. That doesn't really work that well either. There's an interview segment with like a young, cool YouTube influencer that actually doesn't work at all. It's really just kind of like a leaden balloon. There's a couple of scenes that touch on how it could be funny when Emma Thompson is really funny when she goes out into the street and interviews people. Those segments are funny. There's the one time you see her be kind of funny on this. Otherwise, I don't think the comedy itself within the show is funny enough. Then, of course, obviously the overarching theme of it, which is women breaking into a male comedy world. It's weird because the math is wrong on it, right? Like when the movie starts, one of the writers from her show is fired. And as he's fired, he says, well, one of the reasons that your show doesn't work anymore is because you hate women, which sounds like, oh, OK, this looks like a theme of the movie. But it doesn't seem to be, actually. Like, the movie just kind of drops it. Like, it's like the idea of, like, Emma Thompson having, like, the idea of this late person who's succeeded in late night for so many years in this male-driven world that has put together this big show but hates women? That's interesting. I'd like to see that followed up on, and it never really follows up on it very much. The idea of the all-male writing room sounds interesting, and the idea of Mindy Kaling having to come in and break through. And again, she's charming. I actually think that the writer's room is maybe overstaffed with good actors. There's like a lot of really good actors that I would expect to, you could go farther down the chair, down the casting line. It's all, I feel like they're all really well cast, but it feels like the movie is almost like, it's one thing that like to see the things that she would have to deal with breaking into an all male writing room. The movie is a little bit too cartoonish about it. The idea that like there's a women's restroom, but it's just where the guys poop in, like feels like, okay, you're going to have to be a little sharper than that if you're going to do that. And there's a couple good things. I like the way that she tries to ingratiate herself and she doesn't want to take a chair. She'll sit on a garbage bag. That's really good. That's funny. And the movie just kind of stops. There's a complication involving one of the writers on the staff in a controversy. Once that controversy explodes, that character just disappears and the movie doesn't want to deal with them at all. I feel like the movie's not honest enough and like sharp enough. It wants to like touch on these themes, but it never really invests in any of them because it kind of just wants to be like a little bit of a heart warmer. And I think it is charming. I think the actors in the film are all charming. I think it's funny. It's just not funny or sharp enough for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the movies that came to mind while I was watching it was thinking about The Devil Wears Prada, which is
better than this.
Which is better than this. And I think also, now that's a world I don't know at all. So maybe someone with more specificity would know what that movie gets wrong. But inviting you into a world and saying, these are the rules, this is how it works, was really fascinating in Devil Wears Prada. Also, because that character was so well drawn, you felt the gravitational pull of that character and the fear of, oh God, nobody wants to piss her off. And that worked really well in Devil Wears Prada. With this one, it is a little softer. It is interesting to, because I felt this while watching the movie, because I really went back and forth myself in terms of, does this work enough? Does it not work enough? And one of the things I was thinking is that this is a movie that feels like it is much more, the movies we were describing, right? Whether it's like something like 30 Rock or Studio 60 or the Louis C.K. segment where is he maybe going to take over for Letterman or Larry Sanders, they very much feel like they are playing to comedy nerds. It's very much inside baseball, a lot of that stuff. I don't know if it is intentional or not, but this movie doesn't do that. This movie does not feel like, I mean, Mindy Kaling knows comedy. She's worked in comedy for a very long time. It is interesting that the movie does not seem as interested in that stuff. To your point, one of the things I think is also a problem in this film is that when she goes to see one of the other writers do stand-up, it's not funny at all. Like, it's like Hugh Dancy's stuff is actually not funny. The genius, the like eternal genius of what Tina Fey did with 30 Rock was she established from the beginning that TGS was not a good show. That was always the best thing that she did because then stuff did not have to be funny. It was not a prerequisite, whereas Aaron Sorkin established the show as being like this like groundbreaking, cutting-edge, great show, and so it raised the expectation. TGS was supposed to be bad, and so everything that they did was funny because it wasn't all that funny. That is kind of a problem here as well. The other problem, I would say, is I kind of wish that the idea, I don't know if this is a spoiler, I don't think it is, the trick to what Catherine needs to do to be more relevant and to be funnier is to what? Be more herself. And there was a thing about that I found, I think it ultimately works in a way. But that to me, I was like, oh, don't let that be the thing because we have a scene where Catherine does stand up kind of impromptu and she bombs and she's doing terribly and it's kind of awkward for everybody. And she then starts to get real. And I don't do stand-up. I have a lot of admiration for people who do because I don't have the guts to do it myself. But to use as a means of comparison, Tig Notaro's groundbreaking, like sort of like show stopping, people got to really kind of realize who she was as a talent is when she went to Largo and talked about the fact that she had cancer and that her mom had just, you know, her mom had died or was dying. I forget now which. And the shock of that stand-up set was her being real, but also being funny simultaneously, and the audience not knowing how to react to the shock mixed with the humor. Obviously, nothing as traumatic happens to the Emma Thompson character. But again, it's like, I'm not even in the world of stand-up, but I can see that that's a difference in terms of real life versus how it's portrayed in the movie. And like I said, to me, this movie is... it is a wouldn't it be nice if life was like this kind of thing. That is how the movie is done.
Which is fine if it steers all the way into the curve on that. But it doesn't. It kind of wants it both ways.
I think that is, put it this way, I think that the movie does that somewhat. But I think as it goes along, I think it becomes more of a fantasy. And I think I was willing to accept, because there is a scene which I think is somewhat intentionally a riff on something that happens in romantic comedy sometimes, except the two characters in this movie are different than the typical romantic comedy thing. And the way that that scene is actually done, I think, works and basically acknowledges, yeah, this is a fantasy romantic comedy kind of thing. This is actually not in the real world. I agree the movie does try to have it both ways. I think the movie just kind of gives into what is its actual spirit as it goes along eventually. I mean, listen, this is a movie where a character has to deliver a speech and an audience stands up and applauds in a situation where that probably is not actually going to happen. There's a lot of stuff that doesn't work. I completely agree. I can't deny that the sweetness of this film and the general just kind of good vibes it kind of gives off. And while it's not as funny as I would like it to be, I do think it's actually amusing enough and funny enough. And there is enough stuff in it that I actually liked that I kept thinking, you know, gee, I wish this was better. It's funny because, you know, Mark Harris wrote a tweet this week, sort of a subtweet about basically stop telling me that things I should see are important. Like if they're good or they're not good, that's all I care about. And I think people sort of, what was he talking about? And people sort of guessed he was talking about Always Be My Maybe, which I have not yet seen. But his point was, stop telling me I should see that movie and support it because it's important, because it's, you know, non-white actors, written by non-white actors. Don't let that be the reason why I see it. If it's good or not, that should make the difference. While I have a lot of issues with that in general, I did, while watching Late Night, go, damn it, you've got all the things here. You've got all the components. You've got all the ingredients. You've got something that I really, really want to like. Can't it also be really, really good? And that is the thing that to me was the frustration of this thing, where it's like, and it did really well this weekend. I think Amazon very smartly pulled back in terms of how many screens they showed this on. It was just in LA and New York. And so they had a great per screen average this weekend. It was a smart move. I think, especially after Booksmart didn't do so well per screen because they opened it wide immediately. I think Amazon is thinking we're going to start small and grow this movie. I think that's the right call. I wish it was better. I wish it was better. And I think every point you have raised, I completely agree with. There was just enough stuff also in it that I did like, that I was like, okay. And my other question, so Catherine Newbery's like logo for her show, that's the Colbert Show, right? Like, it looks exactly the same.
Yeah. The old Colbert Show, not the new one.
No, the new one. It looks exactly like. And it's funny because Colbert is not referenced in it.
Yeah, also, that's kind of weird, too, because in this universe, apparently, Conan O'Brien may or may not exist. Letterman obviously doesn't exist, because there would have been some reference, because I think there are things from her that are inspired by Letterman a little bit.
Absolutely.
And so Letterman apparently doesn't exist. But Seth Meyers exists, which is also kind of weird. I couldn't figure out what world we were in. And again, I know that sounds strange, and it's maybe even a little pedantic, but again, people that are into late night shows are really into late night shows, and not just the shows themselves, but all the backdrop and the ratings and who's winning and what this person's like to work with and the cutthroat world. I've cried out. There's been several movies and tons of books written about the world of late night. There's one of the greatest TV series of all time is about the world of late night. It's a place that has a lot of fascination for people that this movie is not particularly rigorous about.
Yeah, I think what is interesting, what I'd love to know is it's hard not to, well, actually the movie because of that and be like, well, actually it's not like this. I'm kind of curious because Kaling has the credentials, like she has the background. I'm sort of curious. It's not like she doesn't know this world. It definitely feels like a decision not to have it be as rigorously realistic in that way. I actually would love to know genuinely if that was something that she decided to not worry so much about or what the decision was, because it's not like she hasn't written for late night, but you know, she knows the world of comedy, you know, from The Office and everything else. It's not like she would be, it's not as if she couldn't find out the research if she wanted to talk to people, because she knows that world. She and Colbert are good buddies. So I am curious about that. I put it this way. I think this movie is good and at the same time still a missed opportunity to do something really great in this realm.
All right. So what did you give it?
I gave it a B-.
I give it a C. I couldn't get there. Sorry. It's kind of a bummer. But shout out to Willie Cho alum, Reed Scott. Probably his biggest movie role. I'll give him that.
Yeah. I think he's good. I think John Early is also... really is really good. Yeah.
All right, so I'm going to go away for a moment while Grierson Soul is on a movie that I'm very excited to see and wanted to get this week, but wasn't able to. So Grierson is going to talk to us about The Last Black Man in San Francisco.
We built these ships. Dredge these canals in the San Francisco they never knew existed. This is our home. You two stick together.
The Last Black Man in San Francisco is the directorial debut, I believe, of Joe Talbot, who also co-wrote the screenplay. Based on a story by him and his really good friend growing up, Jimmy Fails, who is the star of the movie, who plays Jimmy Fails. It is basically a lightly fictionalized version of Jimmy Fails' life in San Francisco. The movie is about Jimmy Fails, who is perhaps the last black man in San Francisco. He and his buddy... Montgomery, played by Jonathan Majors, they live in San Francisco, which is a heavily, as anybody knows who reads the paper, a heavily gentrified city. And what Jimmy wants to do is he grew up in a beautiful house in the Fillmore District, if I'm getting my San Francisco geography correct. He lived in a beautiful house in the Fillmore District growing up. And his family no longer owns the house. A white family lives there. But that does not stop Jimmy from making the occasional repairs around the outside of the house because he is determined that one day he will get that house again. One day that white family moves out. No one has moved in yet. And so Jimmy decides he is just going to occupy the house. He is just going to hold on to it, and maybe nobody will ever decide to move in. Last Black Man in San Francisco, like Late Night, premiered in Sundance. I actually did see this at Sundance. It is one of the sort of critical hits of the festival. It is it's a fantastical movie in a different way than Late Night is. If Late Night is a movie that sort of says, oh, wouldn't it be nice if people were more like this? Last Black Man in San Francisco has more of a poetic, sort of impressionistic vibe. We sort of follow around Jimmy as he kind of goes through the city, sort of imagining a more sort of spectacular, beautiful, majestic San Francisco than maybe it is anymore. It's sort of the San Francisco of his youth and of his mind. And some of that can go, can be a bit much. This movie reminds me in certain ways of other sort of like low budget indies that have this sort of like fantastical, like We the Animals from last year, which was not a widely seen movie. But in these types of movies, there's something where it's almost like it's not supposed to be realistic. It's supposed to be kind of operating on a higher level in a way, almost like a dreamlike kind of state. And yet, there's something really kind of poetic and beautiful about the movie at the same time. You really get a sense of not just a city, but a community and a way of life that is going away. It's pretty fashionable. It's pretty obvious these days, whether you're rooting against the Golden State Warriors or just sort of following the tech world, to kind of hate what San Francisco has become. A very much like rich, gentrified, sort of diminished city in a lot of ways. And Last Black Man in San Francisco really kind of speaks to that in a lot of ways. It's hard not to kind of feel what Joe Talbot and Jimmy Fails are kind of getting at. Joe and Jimmy are childhood friends. They've grown up together and they sort of know each other really well. And you feel the sense of two guys who have kind of are kind of pouring their hearts into a movie that means a lot to them. This is not a movie that has a lot of plot. This is not a movie that has a lot of narrative in it. It co-stars Danny Glover. It's one of the better things that Danny Glover's done in quite some time. But it's a movie that more sort of floats. It's more of a film about sort of the experience of being with Jimmy and him kind of trying to recapture something that is probably never going to come back and how he is going to live with that. It's very much sort of a love letter to a city that is no longer the city that he grew up in. And we've had some movies like this recently, whether it's Blindspotting or even Black Panther to a certain extent. Certainly Sorry to Bother You is also a movie that kind of speaks to these same types of things. And it's crazy how different all of these movies are. Last Black Man in San Francisco might be my favorite of the group. You have to have patience with it because it does kind of meander and wander around. But once you get kind of used to the rhythm of what this movie's trying to do, I think it's kind of hypnotic. I give it a B+. So now, let's bring back Will.
All right, Gerson, that was The Last Black Man in San Francisco. I'm going to see that movie. Hopefully I'll get the chance to see that movie before our mid-year best six movies of 2019 show, which is just in a few weeks.
Yeah, it's just around the corner. I can tell you what I thought of it now if you want to know.
No, no, Gerson, the whole point of me, damn it, this is not the first time we've done this.
I just love doing that. And then for a brief second, you're like, wait, does he forget how the show operates?
Did Gerson have a stroke? all right. I think that a lot, actually. Usually once an episode. All right. Now we go to our reboot movie this week. Our reboot movie is Pontypool.
They cut into our signal.
Ken?
And their eyes. He's looking at me.
Pontypool is directed by Bruce McDonald. Came out in 2008. It's a Canadian film. It's written by Tony Burgess, based off his novel. Apparently, he has a series of Pontypool science fiction novels. This is the second in the series. I looked this up. I've done my research. This is the second of the Pontypool trilogy, is what they made this movie into. This stars Stephen McHattie, who I remember almost only seeing. I was like, where have I seen this guy before? Because I knew nothing about this movie at all. But did you know anything about this movie before we started, Grayson?
Other than its existence, no, nothing.
I don't even think I knew about his existence. So this was entirely new to me. But I saw this guy. I was like, where have I seen this guy before? And he was on he was on several Seinfeld episodes.
Yes, that's right.
That was where I knew him from. So Stephen McHattie plays a man named Grant Mazzi, who is apparently like a shock jock radio dude. Though I would say there's nothing really that shocking he says in the movie, at least for the first half, or at least what his reputation would be.
It is Canada, just to throw that in there. So.
It's true. It's true. That's true. They're more easily shocked. They have so many things to be shocked about. I'm sorry. Anyway, he's a shock juke. Yeah, he's a shock juke. Get it? Shock juke. You see, because he's a shock. Anyway, so he's a shock juke who goes to this small town in Ontario called Pontypool, the small area, where he has like a new producer. There he has two. He has a producer and a station manager. A station manager, a woman named Laurel Ann, played by Lisa Hooley,
who's actually married. That's Georgina Riley.
Oh, sorry, I have that backwards. You're right. Sorry. Right. The producer is in Sydney, played by Lisa Hooley, who is, in fact, Stephen McKetty's wife in real life. Ding, ding, I didn't know that.
That's correct.
So, and then Laurel Ann, played by Georgina Riley, is like an assistant, kind of like a tech person. And basically they're doing this morning radio. It seems to be, even though he drives through the night, I think it's a morning radio show. And he's doing the show, and you know he pours a little to let you know what kind of dude he is. He's got a gravelly voice. He wears a cowboy hat, and he puts hard alcohol in his coffee. So that's the type of dude that we're dealing with. As he's driving into the studio, some woman accosts him and just starts saying blood, 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 and that's weird. And it kind of sets the whole movie in kind of this weird place. He starts talking, and they start getting reports. Over the from their guy in a helicopter, who's not actually in a helicopter at all, the traffic guy, about people attacking a certain doctor's office, and they're all kind of chanting the same things over and over. We kind of learn more about what's going on, and it appears, I don't want to give away too much of this, but there's some sort of virus slash outbreak going on, and it is being passed between people in an unconventional manner that fits the setting of the movie, we'll put it.
Through porking.
Yes, not through porking. That would be a very conventional
manner. That'd be very conventional. Oh, porking. Oh, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Wait, like the tracks. We've seen that.
real fast. I'm just imagining, wait, it's through porking. Oh, yeah, that's... Yeah, so just don't pork anybody. Yeah,
that's how I would imagine. Yeah, just knock it off. Just take it easy. Anyway, so basically, therefore, the virus outbreak starts to come closer to their station, and then it has to try to figure out how to stay alive and or not spread the virus as the authorities kind of close in. Our reboot requester, who I assume is Canadian, I feel like you need like a home field advantage to have this movie really jump out at you. Kind of noted that it was a pseudo zombie movie, and there are certain zombie aspects to it. There are definitely some grotesque scenes. It's kind of a we've talked before about how we always kind of find it impressive when low budget movies, and this is definitely a low budget movie, are able to be creepy and scary without a lot of effects, and kind of like hint at scary things just off a frame or have like a general vibe and so on. And I think this does a little bit of that. And the idea behind it of how the virus is being spread is interesting. I'm not sure I entirely understood it. And I also feel like it is a metaphor striving for a larger significance than the movie is maybe able to quite hold. I also feel like there's a certain kind of weird, and maybe this is a Ontario humor that I don't get, but there's a certain kind of, Bruce McDonald, the guy that directed the movie, is kind of known as a cult horror film director. And I feel like there's a little part of the movie where there are moments that are scary and moments that are gory, but there's also a little bit of remove, like, I may just be kind of screwing with you a little bit, that I think is abundantly clear in a post-credits sequence that kind of comes with the movie, to where it feels like, okay, I'm probably not entirely on this movie's wavelength. And the idea of, there's some interesting stuff in here, the idea of talk radio as a place that is able to spread things throughout the world that are making the world worse is something that is touched on, not explored too deeply, but enough that it's clearly meant to be there and doesn't hit home too hard. There's some plotting stuff that's weird. I would say that I would argue in a movie that's all takes place in one radio station where people are trying to figure out what's going on in the outside world, having a doctor who can explain what's going on just show up at the station is cheating. I'm sorry, but that's cheating. And so, and I think a lot of his scenes are really silly, and they really seem to just show up to explain stuff to us. I didn't think it was bad, but I didn't think it was interesting enough to rise to the level of anything of particularly new to say about kind of the genre of zombie movies. I would say that it's not bad. I didn't strike me as incredibly interesting. I would also say that a large part of this made me wish I was watching talk radio, and I hope that someone out there will give me, put in the reboot. I forgot how much I love the movie Talk Radio with Eric Bogosian, directed by Oliver Stone, and a great young Alec Baldwin in that movie. A lot of it made me wish I was watching that. I didn't think it was bad, but I didn't find it all that compelling.
I liked it enough. I clearly have a fondness for this kind of midnight movie that I do sort of forgive a decent amount. I will also describe the optimum viewing experience because I experienced it. I woke up like crazy early one morning. It was like 5:30 or something. I couldn't fall back asleep. So I thought, you know what? I need to see the movie. I'll just watch it right now. So I put it in my computer, put on my headphones and watched it in my office. And I decided that that was actually the best way to do it because it's almost exactly the time when the movie starts, which is around 6 a.m. And I think especially having earphones on while watching this movie, it actually works really, really well. Because the thing that really stands out is not just the performance by Mick Hattie, but also just listening to his voice becomes incredibly important, I think. I like the low budget, one location conceit of the film. I think it works really well, specifically because I think it gets at something that I don't think the movie has been given enough credit for, which is that what used to be so great about the radio, you and me being baseball people, people older than us, the previous generations would always say what was great about watching or listening to baseball on the radio was you got to make the pictures in your mind. The descriptions of things was more colorful than actually seeing them on television. Obviously, the main appeal of War of the Worlds, the Orson Welles performance, was the exact same thing of creating fear and horror in the listener's mind that they create a visual of, but they simply heard it. And I think that the first half of the movie especially works really well in capturing a sense of dread of what exactly is happening, what is going on, and it is getting closer to the radio station where they are at. I'm not sure if it's cheating per se, but it really helps if you have a window that a doctor can just crawl into and then start explaining things. I'm surprised.
Yes, I did touch on that.
Yeah, no,
I did touch
on that. But the one that you didn't complain about, which you should have, which is if they do establish eventually, okay, the porking thing is not the problem, but to not spoil anything, you can't do this. If you don't do this one thing, it will probably help to not spread the virus. And they keep doing it anyway. That is a problem. For me, this type of movie, there are three things it has to do properly. Number one, its premise has to be pretty clever. I think its premise, its horror premise, I think it actually is pretty clever. Number two, when they finally explain, okay, this is, we weren't sure what's going on, but this is what's going on. It has to do that. I think it does that pretty well too. The third one is, okay, now that you know that, how are we going to end this? What's the big ending for the movie? I don't think it does that part really well. I think the movie does lose momentum, but I think it holds long enough. I was still kind of into it. Its end credits scene feels very much just like fucking around, and I was willing to just kind of go with it. I think Mick Hattie is really good playing a character who is kind of ridiculous and kind of broad, and what Mick Hattie brings to it, I think makes it more compelling than it is on the page. His wife, I think, is a little bit less good. I think that her character is unfortunately burdened with, no, we said don't do this, why do you keep doing this? And that's a problem in the movie. I like Georgina Riley, who has a little bit less to do as well, but I like her in it. The three of them in the room not knowing what's going on, I found pretty compelling. I actually found that pretty arresting. And then just hearing voices when they're getting callers or they're getting information and that you can't entirely trust the information, it's kind of in bits and pieces, that I think all works pretty well. I think what also helps the movie is that I didn't think for one single second that the movie had anything to do with about anything else. Like any sort of grander notions this movie is going for so completely bypassed me. And I was sort of grateful for that because this movie cannot sustain thematic depth of any kind. So I was totally fine with that being the case. With these sort of midnight movies, I mostly just ask that they suspend my disbelief long enough and put me into an emotional state long enough that I am riveted to the point that I don't think too much about what's happening. They simply accept the reality that's presented to me. This movie did that enough for me. That worked well enough that I was willing to enjoy. I have never seen any of Bruce McDonald's other stuff. I know he did Tracy Fragments and Hellions and some other recent things. This is my first movie of his that I've seen. And it seemed it seemed how to work a low budget premise strongly enough that, yeah, I was willing to go for it. I liked it enough.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't quite like it enough, but I have no... This movie did not inspire any ill will in me, but I also had a hard time getting excited about it. Like, I don't know. I don't mean any offense to OJ and Candeza, who gave us this suggestion, but, like, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of movies out there. This is not a bad movie in a stretch of the imagination, but it didn't feel, like, inspired enough to me. I bet the book is actually kind of interesting, right? Because the premise of it, again, to be careful, so much of it's about words and so about what the meaning of words and how you speak words. And that seems to me both something I would enjoy more on the page and could find very clever on the page, and made me respect the movie for trying to somehow dramatize that in a movie setting. But I think ultimately made me want to read the book a little more. I don't know. The book would have... all the extra O's in all the words. It'd be like a zoom.
I think the problem with the book would be you don't get to focus on, and this is where I think McDonald does a really good job, you don't focus on McHattie's eyes the way that this movie does. I mean, I think this movie does a really good job of creating claustrophobic scenes. I think actually it's framed really well because a lot of this movie is that shock jock guy on the radio. He's either talking to the listening audience or talking to his producer, and he's kind of just in that booth most of the time. And I think McDonald does a really good job of breaking that up enough that you actually don't feel like you're kind of just trapped in a room and you just want to like break free of it. I think he does a really good job of that. And I think McHattie's voice, his eyes, the intensity, and also that you actually don't know much about that character. I'd be kind of curious if there's more backstory to the character in the book. I like not knowing much, and the only things that you learn are essentially the things that he says during the film. By the way, don't call this a zombie movie. Bruce McDonald gets very mad about that because he does not consider this a zombie movie. What happens is, as far as he is concerned, they are not zombies. And I, as a person who...
He's not behind us, right? Like, we can call whatever the hell we want.
Right. I'm just saying, because whenever we talk about 28 Days Later, I always have to do, like, the thing of, like, I know that the people, if we're talking about it or if I'm writing about it, there'll be, like, that portion of the audience that will get mad at me, like, this is not a zombie movie. And I always go, I don't care. I would say any rational human being considers this a zombie movie. I would actually say that this movie... I can buy not being a zombie movie more than 28 Days Later not being a zombie movie. There is something about the way this is done. Though that being said, if you are wanting to eat another human, I think, unfortunately, the zombie community has not done enough to distinguish themselves from other communities to say, hey, like, just because people are biting other people, don't lump us in with them. I'm not blaming a community, but it seems like the zombies should do more to spread awareness about that. If you start biting people, I think you're basically a zombie. I guess that is what kind of the way it works.
Not all zombies, Christian. Not all zombies.
All zombies, yes.
All right, so that was Pontypool. Thank you for that suggestion, OJ and Candeza. We have no reboot next week. Because I think I'm just going to call it reboot when I do Canadian movies right now. That seems like a good compromise. So we don't have any reboots next week because we have four new movies. Count them. Four. One, two, three, four. The first of those new movies is Men in Black International, directed by F. Gary Gray, starring Chris Hemsworth, Tessa Thompson, Liam Neeson. I feel like he was in the news recently. I don't know. Man,
getting some sort of humanitarian prize of some sort. Yes, you have to bring your passport. This is Men in Black International. So if you're going to the theater, make sure you have your passport. They will check it.
Yes. Yes. And also know that the distance between your home and the movie theater will be measured in kilometers, not in miles.
Right. There'll be extra U's in this movie as well.
So this is the fourth Men in Black movie. It's been a while. Emma Thompson's in this as well. And Rebecca Ferguson. Hey, that's whatever she's been up to. Men in Black International. We'll be discussing that next week. If memory serves, Grisha, you love the first Men in Black beyond all comprehension. Yes.
I just think about it now. I'm losing my mind. Yeah. I like that. The first Men in Black is really good. The second one is absolutely god-awful. And the third one is a nice, safe rebound, a soft rebound. Josh Brolin, MVP of that film.
Our second new movie we'll be discussing next week is The Dead Don't Die, written and directed by Jim Jarmusch, fresh off what I would argue is one of his absolute best movies, Patterson. I would argue his last two movies were both particularly excellent. Patterson and Only Lovers Left Alive, two of my absolute favorite Jim Jarmusch movies. Pretty fascinating to see what he does with this. This one stars Bill Murray, Adam Driver, ghouls, Tilda Swinton, Chloe Sevigny, everyone that you would expect to be in a Jim Jarmusch movie, including Iggy Pop, Carol Kane, Tom Waits, and RZA.
Yes.
They're all here.
They make an album together at one point.
Yes. So that's The Dead Don't Die, Jim Jarmusch. Pretty excited about that. Again, that guy is on a roll right now. So very curious to see what he does there. Speaking of filmmakers that have had of some renown, our third new movie is a Netflix movie that will be playing in theaters. And lots of, this is, every once in a while, there's a movie that I have to see for the podcast that I might not otherwise watch. This is not one of those. This is a movie I would watch. The second one is Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story by Martin Scorsese. I've been heard about this for a while. I am very, very excited about this. We are Dylan nerds. We are Scorsese people. This is pretty exciting.
Yes, I have seen this movie. I was lucky enough to see it in a theater. So I have seen it in a theater where people could, I don't know if it's just LA and New York. I don't know if it's expanding beyond that. But yes, it will be in theaters. It'll also be on Netflix. We'll talk about it next week.
And to be clear, Grierson, because I like you've seen it, don't tell me what you thought of it or anything, but like this is not a movie that he made in 1975. This is a movie that he made now, right?
Scorsese, yes. It's yes. It is a yes. Yes. It is
for this is not like the Orson Welles movie. This is not like an Orson Welles movie that he finished so long ago and now has to, and now we're like, hey, it's been unearthed. This is a movie that he made now.
Yes, though there is footage from back in the day. Yes, that there.
Well, I figured. Yes, yes.
And to be clear, they are zombies in this movie.
Okay, good to know. Good to know. Good to know. Stop talking and singing. That's a little Pontypool joke for you all. Okay, and our final new movie, which we're probably going to get to, then we'll see how the week goes. Our final new movie next week is Shaft. Shaft, directed by Tim Story. It is. We've gotten old enough, Grierson, that we are in our second, we are now our third generation of Shaft reboots.
Yes, and they all have the same title, by the way, also worth pointing out. They're like Seal albums, where it's like Seal, 1992, Seal, 1995. Yeah, yeah. If you want to make a Peter Gabriel reference there too, you can. Go ahead.
They're like George Foreman's children. They're all named George.
Yes.
This is Shaft, starring Samuel L. Jackson as Shaft, and Richard Roundtree as Shaft, and Jesse Usher as Shaft, and Regina Hall as someone other than Shaft, I would presume.
Shaft's friend,
Regina Hall. She just got off her shift at the men's restaurant. Anyway, okay, Grierson. So next week we'll be discussing Men in Black International.
The men's restaurant. I was like, what are you talking about? I just now. Take me a second.
Yeah.
Yes. That was a reference to a indie film of some renown from last year. Yes.
Andrew Bajalski. I'm down with that dude. Men in Black International, The Dead Don't Die, Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story, and probably Shaft.
Parentheses 2019, close parentheses. Yeah.
Yes. Lots of meat on our bones next week, actually, Grierson. I'm kind of excited about next week's
show. Yes.
I think it's going to be pretty fun. I usually don't care about any of these at all, but I am excited about this.
Yeah, you didn't like anything this week, so you're hopeful for next week.
I would say of the three movies, the one I like the most is probably Pontypool, and I was not crazy about Pontypool.
Pontypool was the one I like the most as well.
It's good.
All right, Grierson, have a great week. I will talk to you next week about them Dar 4 movies.
Bye.
Bye.
This shouldn't work, but it does. It only works 'cause of us. And should anyone say different, at all, this only works 'cause of us.